Okay, this is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is October 18. The time is approximately noon. I am accompanied by various members of the commission at the commission's headquarters. We are at commission headquarters for the telephonic interview of Mr. Mike Harder. The interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Harder. Mr. Harder, could I please get your verbal assent for that?
I agree.
Thank you, sir. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name. I'll start it. We'll go around in turn here, and then I'll bring you in. Cunicelli is C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I, and I'm with the commission.
Bob Hinckley, H-I-N-K-L-E-Y, with the staff of the commission.
Tom Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
John Armstrong, A-R-M-S-T-R-O-N-G-F-C-I-C.
Okay, Mr. Harder, why don't you do so, and then we'll bring in your attorneys.
My name is Michael Harder. Last name is H-A-R-T-E-R. First name Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L.
And at Covington & Burling, it's Rob Kellner and Derek Lawler.
All right. Mr. Harder, in the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute, Public Law 111-21, and signed into law by the President. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It is charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by December 15, 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide you a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed, if you so desire. If you do desire that, just please express it, and I'll make it available to you through counsel. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code, Section 1001, concerning false statements. In the way of housekeeping, please make sure that all your responses are verbal and audible. And I would caution you that proceedings before the commission are confidential. Other than discussing this matter with your legal counsel, we would ask you not to discuss topics presented with anyone else. With that, I'll turn the questioning over to Mr. Krebs and Hinckley.
Mr. Harder, please give us your educational background, if you would, please.
I have a
You're starting at high school.
Bachelor's.
Starting after high school.
I have a Bachelor of Science degree. Let me pull up my resume. From the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse in finance and economics. And I also have a Master's of Business Administration from the University of Minnesota. Concentration in finance.
Would you please give us your employment background?
Starting out of undergrad, I worked for the Comptroller of the Currency for about 4 years as a junior national bank examiner. I then went back to grad school, and out of grad school, I worked for U.S. Bancorp, formerly First Bank System, based here in Minneapolis, for about 11 years in a corporate lending, commercial lending capacity, and then have spent the last 8 years at Wells Fargo Home Mortgage in the group that I currently run today. My first capacity had been specific to managing our correspondent seller and wholesale broker due diligence and repurchase management and performance management function.
Talk to me a little bit about your activities and duties in connection with dealing with correspondent sellers and the performance of due diligence.
Yes, group that I manage is involved in third-party oversight function for both the correspondent and the wholesale broker channel. For correspondents specifically, as correspondents apply to commence a relationship with Wells Fargo, we perform background and due diligence checks to ensure that the applicant is someone that we want to make do business with, and we also make decisions based on the information provided to us by the applicant as to what type of relationship, in other words, what type of authorities and abilities we're going to provide those correspondent sellers. That's our due diligence and client onboarding function. Once clients are approved with Wells Fargo, we monitor the book of business that they've sold us over time. We use a tool to identify outliers. We're looking primarily at delinquencies and early payment defaults, as well as other key performance factors. And we are monitoring outliers. And as we identify outliers, we look to identify root causes. For example, a delinquency, we're trying to understand, is it, you know, in a conventional book of business or the government book of business, what are the common characteristics or traits? And then once we define a root cause, we're developing an action plan to cure that deficient performance. And to the extent that it can be cured, we continue to do business with that client. If it cannot be cured, ultimately we terminate that client. That's the basis of our ongoing performance monitoring function.
Mr. Harner, what types of relationships were sought by these third parties for which you exercise oversight?
Well, the ability to sell closed loans to Wells Fargo primarily, to sell loans to Wells Fargo, period. Among other things, they would seek the ability to, what we call delegated underwriting, where the client would underwrite and close the loan and then sell to Wells Fargo the loan in a secondary market transaction.
Did this apply to sellers of pools of loans?
There were certain authorities at times we would buy pools of loans from sellers. Primarily it was on a flow basis.
A flow basis meaning individual loan basis?
Single loans, correct.
All right. Describe for me, if you will, the due diligence you performed in connection with the review of offered pools of loans.
Well, as we would get the data tape, basically, for a pool of loans, it would typically contain key credit characteristics of the loans, such as, for example, FICOs of the borrower, the credit score of the borrower, the loan-to-value ratio, and the debt-to-income ratio, among other items. We would evaluate those called bid tapes to form basically the price that we would offer for the pool in an auction scenario. At this point in time, we would not have the loans. If in fact we were successful, I guess, in our bid in winning the pool, the loans would then be delivered, and they would then go through our pre-purchase review processes, just like any single loan or flow loan that's sold to us one by one would go through. And we're looking for typically the loan prospector or DU, desktop underwriter, the Fannie or Freddie decision engine, certification. We're looking for the documents, presence and sufficiency of the documents in support of that automated underwriting certification. And then we would, if a loan had basically all the required elements and this required documentation, we would purchase that loan. To the extent that loans did not meet the minimum requirements, we had the ultimate right to kick those loans from the pool and would do so. Typically, we would notify the investor that there was something missing with this loan. If they could cure it, great, then we would buy it. If they could not, we would kick that loan, and that loan would be dropped from pool.
Typically, what was the size of the pools of loans that you had occasion to review?
I really don't have that information handy. I'd hate to hazard a guess. I can get that information if you would like.
Well, perhaps we would like that, depending on the response to the next several questions. Did you do 100% review of all the loans in the pools?
If we won the pool prior to boarding, yes, 100%.
What was the size of your group there at Wells Fargo?
Well,
Which group? We were talking about the due diligence with respect to loan pools, and I'm trying to determine the number of folks within that department who were dedicated to the due diligence of loan pools.
My group doesn't do the loan boarding. The team that would look at the data tapes to help our capital markets group decide on a price. So let's say there was a 100 loan pool, for example. This is the way this would work. If we got if somebody was offering a 100 loan pool, my team would look at the data tape and would basically provide counsel to the capital markets group or the pricing group that was looking to purchase these loans. That let's say five of them did not fit Wells Fargo guidelines based on the data that was provided in the bid tape. So our bid then would be based on 95 loans because five did not fit the guidelines. And then the capital markets group would make a decision around what price they would offer for 95 of the loans in the pool. If, in fact, we won the pool and they were delivered to Wells Fargo for purchase and funding, that's a separate operations group. That's the line of business group that would look at the loans singly, one by one, and identify either defects or deficiencies in the file. So the group that my team that looked at the initial bid tape is comprised of 3 to 4 folks. But the operations team consists of several hundred.
And the initial bid tape review, what was the data review? Let me back up. When you were approached with respect to and offered a pool of loans, what underwriting standards had been employed in connection with the acquisition of those loans?
Wells Fargo's.
And if XYZ loan originator approached Wells Fargo with a bid package and containing bid tapes, then the loans that had been acquired in that pool, if I understand you correctly, had been acquired pursuant to the underwriting standards articulated by Wells Fargo. Is that correct?
That's correct. There would be some minor variances for clients that if they had negotiated something with Fannie and Freddie under their contract that necessarily Wells wouldn't have, but they were eligible for sale, we would research and investigate those minor variances and allow those to be purchased. because they fit Feeney's and Freddie's guidelines. It's just that Wells Fargo would not have that variance approved under its seller contract, for example.
Did Wells Fargo, during your tenure there in this particular group, ever employ third-party vendors to conduct due diligence?
We did at a at a certain point in our history. We did develop what we called a conduit, where clients were able to sell loans based on our review of the client's guidelines for minimum acceptability and eligibility for sale. This would primarily be to non-agency investors. But we would work with our legal team and our credit policy team to evaluate the client's guidelines, and the clients then were eligible to sell through the conduit loans that were underwritten primarily to their own guidelines. And in that activity, we did use a third-party review team. I don't know the specific name, but it was Clayton. Was the group that we used to evaluate some of the files in those pools.
On how many occasions, just give me your best guess, how many occasions did you employ Clayton Holdings to conduct third-party due diligence reviews for Wells Fargo?
Probably less than 10. I think the entire volume that we ultimately purchased through the conduit I am hazarding a guess.
Sure.
It is only a guess. We only purchased about $2 to $3 billion ultimately in the conduit of loans.
Do I understand that the due diligence review following the submission of a price for the loans that submitted in the bids, that they were done by a desktop review? Was there any other review done?
I'm sorry, could you repeat
that question? That was very awkward. I apologize. What I'm trying to get at is you referenced a desktop review with the automated underwriting.
That's desktop underwriter. Desktop underwriter and loan prospector are the automated underwriting software for Fannie and Freddie.
Correct.
And what did you do to confirm that the loans submitted to Wells Fargo complied with those underwriting standards?
That question can be best answered by, again, the operational team that did the specific loan-by-loan file review to evaluate whether Wells Fargo would purchase the loan. But generally, we would look generally, and I don't have a detailed understanding because I'm not in the business line and not in the operations group, but we would look for the decision. These automated decision engines had different names for an approve, but we would look for an approve decision in terms of the underwriting of the loan, and then there would be typically messaging that may call out specific documents that needed to be in the file, in addition to standard documents such as the HUD-1, the appraisal, things like that, that were part of our standard MLA, or standard review process. We called it MLA, mortgage and loan acquisition process. So we would review each of those documents prior to purchase of the loan.
When the bid tape was received, someone there, although be it not your department, would set a price for it. Was that price subsequently renegotiated depending upon the outcome of the due diligence reviews? If you know.
Again, I'm not the best person to answer that question. Our capital markets team certainly... Here's what I can say definitively. If the if, you know, and if I go back to a 100 loan pool example, if based on our data tape reviews, we said we could submit a bid only for 95 of the loans in the pool, we could do so, and then we still retain the ability to drop loans from the pool, kick loans out, based on our detailed review of the one once we received the file. And to the extent that a larger number of loans were dropped from the pool, so let's say if 95 loans now became only 75 loans, there may have been circumstances where that may have been renegotiated, the price may have been renegotiated, but I am not nearly the best one to answer that question.
That's fine. You've been proffered here to talk to us about putbacks, and so I apologize to the extent that I caught you somewhat flat-footed with questions that related to due diligence, and I appreciate your responses. So let's get to the subject matter of this telephone call. Tell me about the procedure for putting back loans there in place at Wells Fargo.
So an investor request, whether it be an agency, Fannie Freddie or FHA, or a non-agency investor, a Wall Street investor, would identify a deficiency in the loan. They would send a demand back to Wells Fargo. It's a group, our repurchase management team would receive that request. They're receiving requests for all three lines of business, not just our correspondent business. For the correspondent for the loans that were originated in our correspondent channel, they would pass through the demand requests to my team. What that initiates then is what we call our soft letter process. So the first step is to notify the originating lender of a repurchase demand request by the investor on a specific loan, and then we would pass through the nature of the defect alleged by the investor, and we would ask for any, you know, additional information or documentation that they may have to address the defect that's noted by the investor. The client may or may not have something that they forward to address the defect. To the extent that they have something, we would take that back, have a discussion with the investor, and if that either missing documentation, let's say, or additional information would cure the defect, then that loan would stay with the investor, because again, it is an investment quality loan. The defect that was noted was by the investor was cured by additional information provided by the originating lender. To the extent that the loan couldn't be cured, either the client did not have additional information or the information they provided was insufficient to cure the defect, Wells Fargo would then repurchase the loan, and then at that point in time, we would bill or invoice our client for repurchase of that loan. The repurchase or invoice process would not start prior to Wells Fargo owning the loan again, because we cannot have our client repurchase something that we don't own. So once we would repurchase the loan, we would then turn around and invoice the client for repurchase of the loan. In some instances, if the loan went through foreclosure and liquidation, we would bill what we call a make-whole. So if the let's say $100,000 loan was foreclosed upon and sold, recovering $80,000 worth of value to the investor, Wells Fargo would then remit funds, $20,000 to the investor in this example, to make the investor whole. We would turn around and bill our client $20,000 to make ourselves whole. So we were typically putting back either full loan repurchase requests or make whole amounts if the underlying property had been foreclosed upon and sold in REO.
Yeah, who were these investors, Mike?
Our direct investors would be Fannie, Freddie, FHA, or a number of non-agency investors who could be anything from Wall Street firms to, I don't know, private equity trusts, I guess. But again, the investors is not, I'm not in the best position to answer that. That would be our capital markets group that conducted those sales.
The sales that occurred between Wells Fargo and the investor were done pursuant to representations as to quality or just representations and warranties related to the loans, or to the extent there was a difference. Is that correct?
Well, we have our seller contracts directly with the investors where we, wherein we make representations and warranties to Fannie under our contract with Fannie, to Freddie under our contract with Freddie, and those may be have different provisions under our contract with FHA, which may have yet different contractual provisions, and any number of non-agency Wall Street investors, again, each of whom we would have executed a separate and single selling contract.
Excuse me for interrupting, Mike, but is it that selling contract that contains the representations and warrants?
That we make to our investors.
Yes.
That Wells Fargo Home Mortgage makes to its investors.
That was my question, yes. That was an affirmative
then
answer?
Correct.
All right. I'm sorry if I seem to be stepping on your answer, so I apologize. I will refrain. Go ahead and finish, please.
I think Mike's finished.
Okay. Mike, to what extent then did Wells Fargo, in connection with its purchase of loans that were subsequently sold to investors, to what extent did Wells Fargo rely on representations and warranties given to it in connection with that sale?
Well, we had our separate contracts then with each of our originating sellers. So we had, and there are two components. We have our loan purchase agreement, which is about a three-page generic document that refers to all of the provisions in our seller guide. And our seller guide then is the other half of our contractual basis. That would contain all of our product and program parameters, our underwriting guidelines, all of the representations and warranties that our sellers make to us. And it would also define then, you know, our remedies in the event of a breach or an event of default under the reps and warranties made by each of our clients. That seller guide is a very thick document. It is amended often as market conditions change. And so between the two pieces of the loan purchase agreement, which incorporates by reference the entirety of the selling guide, which is the second document, those are the two documents that form the basis of the contractual relationship between ourselves and the sellers selling to us. And we would execute that contract with each and every seller in every case in the corresponding channel.
When you have a seller to Wells Fargo and on a loan or series of loans or pool of loans that are subsequently sold to an investor, what type of documents are presented, and I'm talking about documents relating to title, are presented to Wells Fargo? Do you receive a note and a mortgage?
In all cases, we need both the promissory note and the mortgage prior to our purchase.
Is that note and that mortgage assigned to Wells Fargo?
I wouldn't be the best to answer. I believe that it is. It has to be because we need to have true and correct ownership of the underlying collateral, so to speak, or the property. But how exactly that's done, you know, our legal group would be in a better position, or our operations group would be in a far better position to answer, but I believe that that is the case, correct.
Is it your belief also that whatever you get, you sell or you transfer to the investor?
Correct. Unless we are holding, transferring it, yes. And we may be holding them on their behalf, but we would be transferring that to the investor.
Holding on their behalf, tell me what that means.
You know, I really don't know in terms of our servicing. That would be our servicing group. Or frankly, in a corporate trust capacity for a security, we may be safeguarding it on their behalf under corporate trust arrangement, but I really don't know. In terms of ownership, we are definitely transferring that to the investor.
Are you familiar with an entity called MERS?
I am.
Tell us about MERS and how you come to know it.
Again, I'm not the best person internally to understand MERS, but as I've understood it, MERS is an entity created to facilitate the transfer in an electronic way. The underlying collateral of the mortgages being put in various securities.
Do you have any understanding in connection with whether or not any filing is made on behalf, do you know whether any filing is made in the local county courthouse when a transfer is made to Wells Fargo?
I'm not in a position to answer that question definitively.
Well, let me ask it again on the other side. Are you familiar, are you knowledgeable, or do you know whether or not Wells Fargo itself causes to be made or has made for it a transfer to your investor once you sell that loan or pool of loans to that investor?
I'm not knowledgeable of that process. I'm not the one to answer that question.
In connection with the request for putback information, we asked the question, what types of missing documents was it that caused you to send back or to put back a loan or to have one put back to you? And there were several answers given. There was income documents, asset documents, AUS cert, paren LP or DU. Can you tell me what AUS cert, paren LP or DU means?
AUS cert refers to the, again, AUS stands for Automated Underwriting System. LP refers to Loan Prospector, which is Freddie Mac's branded automated underwriting system. DU refers to Desktop Underwriter, which is Fannie Mae's automated underwriting system. And the certification, so when you put in information into these tools, LP or DU, it provides back an underwriting called certification. So again, that's where it would either approve or decline the loan based on the information that was input into the tool. So one of the things we would look for is for the underwriting the system certification document that would evidence that the loan was underwritten and passed by these systems, which would in turn mean that at least to the extent that the information was true and accurate, the loan was eligible in conformance with Fannie's or Freddie's guidelines and eligible for sale to them.
So that missing that document, the AUS cert, would be a cause to put the loan back. Is that correct?
Well, we would... Correct. To the extent that... well, we would look for that loan, and to the extent that it was missing, we would not purchase the loan, but due to human error... or if we found that the certificate was fabricated, for example, and it was in fact an invalid certification, we would then put that loan back.
Do you recall many instances where the AUS cert was in fact fabricated?
I don't have the specific details on that. I would. My estimate would be that that would be one of the fewer forms of missing documentation.
All right. The HUD 1 report, final version. What does that refer to, please?
There's a HUD 1 statement that's executed in the closing, and it outlines basically the cash inflows and outflows. Various parties in connection with purchase and or sale and purchase of the loan, and it's a required document by the agency investors,
mm-hmm.
and they are subject to change often. In connection with the closing, and so we're often looking for the final version of the HUD one.
Okay. The credit report. What does that contain?
That's the credit report from one of the three credit reporting bureaus that would contain the credit history of the borrowers, obligors on the mortgage loan.
I'm going to skip down to the final one, the final title policy. What does that refer to, please?
Title policy is issued by a title underwriter certifying that the lien that the property is free and clear of any prior liens, and that the only lien that would exist is the one in connection with the mortgage loan being made, and that title policy is subject to insurance being provided by the title underwriter that in fact is correct.
What with respect to putbacks was. You had indicated, I believe, earlier, and I want to find out if this is the only method for it, that you would institute putbacks when your lenders would come back to you and say, we think there's a problem with this loan. Is that the method by which you became alerted to the possibility of a problem with a particular loan?
It's a primary method. It's not the sole method. We perform quality assurance testing on a post-fund basis. In other words, after our purchase of the loan, but prior to sale to the investors. After our purchase, it may or may have not been pooled at that point in time. So it's our own internal quality assurance testing to the extent that we know quality assurance testing in a loan. We would, depending on its status, if it was not sold to investors, we would hold it out from sale to investors, mark it ineligible for sale. Or if it was pooled, we would pull it out of the pool. And to the extent it was already in a security, we are obligated to report the defect to the investors, typically under our seller contracts, and then it is up to the investor to decide what they remedy they would choose to exercise.
How many personnel in your group did you have devoted to the review of loans that had previously been reviewed but not sold to investors?
My team is not the quality assurance testing function. If I've understood your question correctly, that team does not reside within my group. It's within another group. The QA testing group is a team of 25 people that are reviewing files. Within my team, I have four that are doing specific or targeted QA testing. But there are QA, there's also QA that's going on within the business lines as well. So it's a multi-layered testing program that occurs, and any one of those that would note a defect, we would need to notify the investor or hold it out from sale if it has not been sold already.
When your group, the four personnel in your group, target test, how do you determine what is to be targeted?
Primary function of that group, one of the types of relationships being sought by our clients, back to an earlier question, was where we would delegate the underwriting of the loan.
Mm-hmm.
And so the four-person team, specifically within my group, their primary function is to test the production of those clients where we have newly delegated the underwriting authority. So if we've made the decision to recently delegate the underwriting, that team would target those clients and test those loans from a quality assurance perspective to make sure that the underwriting quality is sufficient for Wells Fargo.
So you were testing them to determine how well they carried out the delegation, is that right?
Correct.
In connection with the responses made to us for the put-back information, there's a number of items over the years as given as a reason for a put-back. And missing documents, I think we've already kind of covered. There's a section called Origination Guideline Violation. Can you tell us what that relates to and what that refers to?
Well, in the seller guide, the contract between ourselves and the originating clients, we would outline the credit parameters that Wells Fargo requires its loans to be underwritten to, Wells Fargo's underwriting guidelines. And so to the extent that we've noted a violation of those underwriting guidelines, for example, on a certain product, we may have a maximum loan-to-value ratio, or LTV, of 80% on a loan. And to the extent that we find a loan that where the appraisal was performed but not performed, for example, in compliance with USPAP, and USPAP is an acronym for the for appraisal standards, and I can't quote what USPAP stands for right now, but it's the appraisal quality standards that are outlined in the industry that govern how an appraisal needs to be conducted. But if we would find that the appraisal was deficient in that manner and we conducted our own appraisal, and, for example, we found the value to be lower, the loan to value then would be higher and it no longer meets our guidelines. So that 79% loan to value that was purported to meet our guidelines is now, for example, with a lower value, now 84%. It no longer fits our guidelines. That would be a program violation.
All right. Thank you. Presumably valuation relates to essentially the same thing, the appraisals. Is that correct?
Correct.
employment slash income. And let me just go through the list. Employment slash income and deposit slash assets. Does that relate principally to the inability to determine whether or not the employment and income or deposits and assets were as stated, or does that relate principally to the belief that there might be a reason to think that the whatever figures were used there were incorrect, or, and I hesitate to use the word fraudulent, but because that requires a legal determination, but do you think that those might have been misrepresented? Is that what we're getting at here in those two categories, employment, income, and deposit slash assets?
That's what we're getting primarily at. Those items were misrepresented.
And in connection with the responses to this, our request, there also included a number of other factors, FICO misrep, Social Security number misrep, first lien issues. Presumably, all of those are potentially fraudulent activities, although I'm not asking you to define them as fraudulent. Is that correct?
Correct. Other than first lien issues, first lien issues are typically tied to a settlement agent defalcation, and I say often, not in every case, but often. So we sent money, for example, in a refinance transaction to purchase the loan. Those loan proceeds were, in the control of the settlement agent. Settlement agent was instructed to pay off the prior loan and eliminate the prior lien. The settlement agent did not do so. Committed defalcation, absconded with the funds, whatever, and it turns out that the prior lien was not paid off. So we had put forth funds and purchased a loan that was not in first lien position.
Are you familiar, Mike, with the term suspicious activity report?
I am.
Who is it within your organization that would have been filing suspicious activity reports in connection with possibly fraudulent representations made in the loans purchased by Wells Fargo?
The suspicious activity reports are filed by our corporate security group, and they typically receive unusual event referrals from the fraud team or from other parts or other parties internally that would form the basis of those suspicious activity reports.
Does your group or did your group generate unusual event referrals for purposes of having filed a SARS report?
I've managed the fraud function, fraud investigation function, since October 1st of 2006, and so another team under my management accountability did in fact provide those unusual event referrals when misrepresentation was noted.
When in every case when misrepresentation was noted, was an unusual event referral made, or was that a discretionary call?
To the extent that misrepresentation could be confirmed, that was the procedure, was to complete an unusual event referral.
Now, how many unusual event referrals did you have occasion or your group have occasion to file over the years? Over, just give me an approximate number, 2006, 2007, 2008, and 2009, and year to date, 2010.
I don't have that information handy. I was prepared for a discussion around putback requests and So I apologize.
No, that's quite right.
I've not. This has been a wide-ranging discussion here, and I have not had the chance to pull this stuff information together.
Well, I would have a supplemental request of counsel that if you have an opportunity to do that, just give me the gross numbers. That's all I'm interested in, just so that it conforms to the years listed in the putback. Make it 2007, 2008, 2009, and year-to-date 2010. I'd like a little bit of a note if there were any done before that, if that's all right. And I appreciate
it. Okay, we'll look into that and circle back to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I'm sorry. You would like UERs prior to 2007 as well? Did you say?
If I understood you correctly, I thought that you did say that you were in that group and running it as of 2006. And if they don't have any data, that's fine. But I'll take it for the years listed here.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, Mike. You were in this. Was there a period, a point in time? Well, first off, with respect to the putbacks here, these do not necessarily relate. That putbacks in 2007 might not necessarily relate to loans that were originated in 2007. Is that correct?
Correct. The way we presented these, it was based on the receipt of the investor demand and our putting back to the client, not when the loan was originated.
Mike, is there a point in time where you thought that what you were seeing out there generally, that there was a significant decline in underwriting standards or adherence to underwriting standards in connection with the purchase and sale of a mortgage loan?
Are you asking my opinion? Or
yes,
I'm not a mortgage underwriter, so I don't believe that I'm in the best position to answer that question.
You were looking at mortgages generally, though, with respect to compliance in connection with underwriting guidelines, and what I'm trying to get at was there a point in time when you saw a significant deterioration or a significant widening of the compliance with those guidelines?
I can tell you the largest number of repurchase demands that my group is seeing and that we are executing putback against our clients are concentrated in the 2006, 2007, and 2008 origination vintages, the putback requests for 2005 were elevated, though not from before 2005. So we can see that the repurchase requests for 2005 were elevated from prior years, and then 2006, 7, and 8 were very high relative to even 2005. So that's, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but from that evidence, those would be the three origination years that I would point to.
Additionally, we asked Wells Fargo to identify the top five firms ranked by loan count and total dollar owed with respect to the number of putbacks. And number one in that group was American Home Mortgage Corporation. During this period of time, 2006 through, did there come a point in time where Wells Fargo ceased doing business with American Home Mortgage?
Well, they failed in, I believe it was July of 07. And that entity suffered a liquidity issue and went away very quickly. Wells Fargo ceased its relationship upon that liquidity event in I believe it was July of 2007.
Was there any other entity with which Wells Fargo ultimately concluded it was not in their interest to do business?
That's a pretty broad question.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'll withdraw the question. Let's just talk about Franklin American Mortgage. Are they still around?
Franklin American is around, and they continue to perform. So this amount owed should be clarified. There are certain clients on this list that are out of business. There are other clients that continue to honor their representations and warranties and their obligations under there, and Franklin American is one of those. The numbers, the clients that are identified on this are generally clients where we had a large selling relationship. So just by nature of the volume that they are selling to Wells Fargo, they are going to have a higher count of issues in terms of putbacks or repurchases, even though their rate may not be excessive if we look at it on a volume sold or relative basis.
I think that's a very good point. And just so you know, it is not our intention to point out anybody and put a spotlight on them, unless they certainly deserve it. But it's our intention to only aggregate numbers and present it that way so as not to highlight anyone. And so to the extent that Franklin American Mortgage continues to honor its obligations with Wells Fargo, I doubt very seriously that anybody will be focusing on them for a while. But which of the remaining five are out of business that are listed on the top-ranked firms? We've got American Home Mortgage. They're gone. What about Mortgage IT, Inc.?
Mortgage IT sold its mortgage operation to Deutsche Bank. I believe the acquisition closed January 1st of 2007. Wells Fargo continues to pursue putbacks against Deutsche Bank, pursuant to Deutsche Bank's guarantee of originations by Mortgage IT from January 1st, 2007 forward. So Mortgage IT technically, it may survive as a legal entity, but it is owned by Deutsche Bank at this point. Security National Mortgage Company continues to do business, and First Magnus Financial Corporation also ceased doing business sometime in the third quarter of 2007. So they are no longer an operating entity.
I'm writing, so I'm in good. Any more questions?
Mr. Harder, we have the putbacks from Wells Fargo from Fannie and Freddie. Those numbers seem to be a multiple of the numbers on the chart you provided us with. What's that a result of?
I don't think I can answer that question. I'm not privy to what you have from Fannie and Freddie.
Well, the numbers are higher, which would indicate that your putbacks, you put back less of the loans that they put back to you.
So I'm not sure if the information that you have is for all of Wells Fargo or just for the correspondent channel. I would say our retail channel generates, on average, about half of all of Wells Fargo Home Mortgage's loans in any given year. Our wholesale channel in any given year also generates about 15% of our overall volume. So generally, and I say very generally, our correspondent channel originates only about a third of the entire loans that ultimately may go to Fannie and Freddie.
Yeah.
So to the extent of what you're getting back from Fannie and Freddie, that may be the picture for all of Wells Fargo Home Mortgage. And we don't have the ability to put back loans for credit defects in either, certainly our retail channel, nor in our wholesale channel.
Okay, that's so essentially the information that you have provided us with is only for your part of the business.
For the correspondent originations.
Correct.
It's the place where we exercise putback.
All right.
Rights.
Is the number also likely to be reduced by the fact that there are a number of originators from whom you acquired mortgages that were sent to Fannie and Freddie who are no longer in business and you just did not exercise any putbacks?
Well, the number that we provided, and I'm looking at least a version that I believe was forwarded by Mr. Lawler, and I'm referring to footnote number one under request number one. It includes the loans that we billed to clients or are in the process of being billed. It also includes loans that were billable to clients, for example, American Home, but ultimately we could not bill because the client was no longer in business. So it does include those loans that the information that we provided does include loans that are billable contractually, but are not able to be executed upon given the client's bankruptcy status.
Let me talk just a moment. I've got one more serious question. There are 2,733 loans depicted as being put back here. Are those only the numbers for your group?
Correct.
And do you have any knowledge as to whether or not any putbacks were also generated from other channels, whether they be retail or the any others?
The only other area that I'm aware of is what we call our servicing acquisition business that was executed outside of the correspondent channel, and frankly, the contractual enforcement was not conducted by my group. Our servicing acquisition group, basically what we would acquire is the servicing rights on pools of loans that have been placed with investors previously. By nature of acquiring the servicing rights for Fannie and Freddie loans, we undertook the liability of repurchases in the event that a defect was acquired in the loan. So even though we would consider that primarily kind of a pass-through, again, we were acquiring the servicing rights, we took on the liability for repurchase of any loans found to be defective. And any loans that were coming back from the agencies as part of our servicing acquisition business are not included in these loans, or in these totals, I'm sorry.
So you don't have any access to the totals of those loans through the servicing acquisition facilities or group?
I don't have that information specifically. I believe Wells Fargo can produce that information, but they were not included here.
That would be very helpful to us. What we're attempting to do here is to get an overall picture with respect to the number of loans that may or may not have been purchased or sold as a result of some misrepresentation as part of our misstatements and omissions section. So we would be very much interested in looking at those numbers. Gentlemen, if y'all could, Derek, if you could provide those to us, it'd be helpful.
And I just want to be clear, those loans under our servicing acquisition business, we would not, again, they would have been placed in securities or with investors, and at that point in time, we would not have, performed any file-level due diligence.
I'm not sure I understood that last response. Could you tell me what you mean by that?
Well, I ought to be circumspect here because I did not. I'm not involved in the servicing acquisition, or was not involved in the servicing acquisition business. But it's my understanding that These loans are quite, well, again, we're acquiring primarily servicing acquisition, we're acquiring the servicing rights. And so the loans had been previously placed with investors. So they were in Fannie and Freddie securities already. They were being serviced by another entity already, and so we were purchasing the loans at that point. I'm sorry, purchasing the servicing rights. You know, after they had been placed in securities and had been serviced for a period of time, and so we wouldn't have done the loan level purchase due diligence like we would in our origination or our whole loan acquisition business.
So if I understand you, one possibility is that you acquired servicing rights in connection with trusts that were not generated, created, or whose loans were purchased, were acquired originally by Wells Fargo.
Correct.
Okay. I think I understand. Any questions?
Correct.
Typically, when we get to this point, and I'm through with just about all of my questions based on the putbacks, typically when we wind up interviews, we solicit persons who are engaged in the business, we solicit their opinions as to what caused the financial crisis, and we would solicit that from you now, Mike. What do you think caused the financial crisis? Hello?
I think it's a question that requires a little bit of thought and reflection. Mike, if you have a view, feel free to express it on your own behalf personally.
Certainly. And what we're asking for, Mike, is your opinion and not that of any, you not binding on Wells Fargo.
So there was a cycle of credit competition that I believe, accelerated in that 2005 time frame. What I mean by credit competition is offering products features, reduced documentation features, stated documentation features that bred or facilitated a significant amount of misrepresentation. Because the information could not be verified in a normal underwriting, I believe that the underwriting quality, again, I'm not an underwriter, but I believe that just the fact that the underlying information could not be verified as to its accuracy and validity in and of itself led to a poor underwrite. So that I believe is the credit competition that intensified beginning in 2005 through 2008 or the first part of 2008 led to a performance issues with respect to residential mortgage loans, which may in turn have led to a number of the issues that entities such as Bear Stearns, Lehman, things like that.
Any questions? Mike, thank you so very much. I appreciate it. Derek, Rob, thank you again. We appreciate it. We covet your continued cooperation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.